This is the first of a series of interviews with John Ross on the University Committee in 1987-88. Today is October 23rd, 1987, and we're talking in his office in agricultural journalism. I'm Laura Smale, doing the interview for the University of Wisconsin-Madison Archives Oral History Project.
It seems to me, Laura, that the issues balloon up and are dealt with, and what's important is get some context. As you know, I've been elected to the University Committee and I'm starting a three-year term. I maybe have some perspective because when I was Director of Profs for 7 years, I sat almost every week and observed the University Committee. I've been out of that profs lobby role for a couple of years, but I have some sense of the University Committee in modern times. I'm not a historian. I was not nearly as active or perceptive in faculty governance at the time of the university merger, which was a very crucial time when a lot of things were codified. I do have the sense that the modern university committee, the post-university merger university committee, mission and impact is greater than it was in the early days. A lot of the classical issues on rights and responsibilities and autonomy they're not new. They've been around for generations. But it's a new game. In the last 7 to 8 years, certainly since Ed Young was president of the university, we've had to interpret the faculty's role in the governance under the umbrella of an increasingly aggressive system administration, and under a legislature, certainly since the Lucy years, that has been more inquisitive about and demanding of the university in terms of the governance kinds of issues. This is not to say that tenure or autonomy are threatened any more than they have been. But there's more of a syndrome of management in place. And whether or not the campuses, the institutions are responsive to central direction. And that's changed the chemistry, I think. We've talked before in other interviews about the issue of collective bargaining. And that, to me, really is just a manifestation of this issue of management and how and whether and where decisions get made. The other general thing I think I'd like to say, it's well understood in the archives and in the rules and regulations and in the faculty policies and procedures that this is a system of shared governance. It's not generally understood either within the university and without the university what that really means, shared governance means. It's not faculty governance, it's shared governance. The statutes, Chapter 36, and the rules of the regents are fairly precise and I think quite thorough in spelling out the obligations and responsibilities in shared governance. Where it continues to be interesting is on a specific kind of case what that means. The shared governance means that there is a consultation back and forth between the president and his officers, the chancellors and their officers, and the deans on these things. Neither the faculty or the administration are dominant. There is a shared responsibility. And now with the formal participation of academic staff and governance, there's another major authority in there that shares in the responsibility. It's not yet clear, although there are a lot of students who are trying to carve out their share in the governance of the institution. And the student's role is going to be an interesting thing, certainly in the 3 years of my time on the university committee, because that's all in turmoil now. There's readjustment going on. So in terms of background, modern times are different in the structure, and you are in a sense refighting a lot of the battles that we thought were settled because of the changing administrative structure. That's the first point. And the second point is this one about it's not faculty governance, it's shared governance, and how you work out who makes the decisions along the way. Let me give you a case that's currently not on our campus, but it's very interesting. This is a case of an assistant professor who was hired several years ago at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. And the name is not as important as the issue. The person was brought in and given the responsibility of being a department chair because there were some tribulations within the department. The statutes are clear that the executive committee of a department can recommend a tenure. The department apparently didn't like the idea that an outsider was brought in without tenure, but tenure track, to be the chair, and or their relationship broke down. So department executive committee recommended against tenure. A review committee and the administration at Eau Claire overruled the executive committee. So they have a fight on their hands, and it went back and forth. Eventually, through a whole series of hearings that ended up with the regents, tenure was granted over the objections of the executive committee. Your first reaction is there's a breakdown in the faculty's rights and responsibilities. Mm-hmm. Maybe not. One of the outcomes of this is that you probably shouldn't be reviewed for tenure on the basis of administrative responsibilities or administrative record. And yet we have a lot of appointments here in our institution where people have administrative assignments, and the rules in the divisional committee say that if there is an obligation there, then you ought to be reviewed for the quality of your work in administration. What's coming out of that whole fight is, and I'm not sure this is what should happen, is a proposal from administration at both the system and our campus level to rewrite Chapter 36, which specifies that in certain cases, the authority to recommend for and act on tenure is not in the hands of the Departmental Executive Committee. Goodness. And this is a major change in our philosophy and our policy. At that point, I'm interested in saying, okay, maybe that's necessary to protect the interests and the rights of an individual. Maybe they can get caught politically in a bind by action of an executive committee. But let's be very clear in specifying what those conditions are when you take it out of the hands of an executive committee. So this is an example of the readjustment with the more complicated administrative structure that we didn't have 15 years ago before the merger. what's important in terms of shared governance on an issue like that is that the university committee and or the Senate, the elected representatives of the faculties part of this governance system, really do have a crack at recodifying the procedures, but also on a case-by-case basis. The basic issue here is the tenure and how it's granted, and you don't want to tip the balance so that either side has the final say. I mean, it's shared governance, even on tenure. And so this is an example of changing form. The University of Wisconsin-Madison, first let me say that tenure is the very core of the whole thing. Who gets it? Who sets the tone and who gets it? In that process, this is the whole, the selection and granting of tenure to faculty is the very core issue in all of it, and it is that balance of decision making which is what we seek through the shared governance.
I'm curious, could that have happened on the Madison campus, that the administration would have overridden the department executive committee?
Not the way the statute is written now. It could not, unless you had a breakdown and administration started to take over. No, it could not.
Mm.
I think they made the error in bringing a person in to an administrative spot where an assistant professor tenure track had administrative jurisdiction over tenured people. So there was an error in judgment. Mm. That's beside the point now. The issue is, who has the authority to initiate and or give tenure? And you certainly don't want to give that authority exclusively to the regents or to a president or to a chancellor, or maybe even exclusively to a review body. Depends on how that review body is constituted. I think, on balance, the judgment is that the individual did not get a fair hearing. And so how do you adjust it? It's the process of making that readjustment. I'm always concerned about reopening the statutes. I think you don't go to the state statute governing the university to modify it unless there's a very important reason to do so.
This is being discussed by the university committee now, is
yes.
It? What is the general inclination?
The original proposal for rewriting Chapter 36 on this point was made by system administration. The university committee a year ago suggested a modified revision to the statutes, and it looks like Chapter 36 may well be revised on this point. And I would say that the university's committee's input has been effective in getting that balance of power on how tenure is granted. Mm. The original draft pretty much gave administration and or the regents the right to overrule the executive committees. And as I wasn't in on the debate a year ago, but as I understand it, this university committee here said, no, wait a minute, you know, let's reword it so that you don't tip the balance clear over on that basis of the regents. The regents get, they have one or two cases like this at any given time, and they get a little bit nervous if there are too many of those cases, but inevitably those disagreements are going to arise over individual cases about whether or not somebody had a fair hearing. The important issue here is that the initiating authority and the review authority, like the division, the initiating authority and the executive committee of the department to hire somebody, to recommend their promotion, the divisional committee authority to review it for on qualitative grounds. That's what you have to protect. If you lose that, then you've lost the very core of the quality control. There are cases in my recollection in the history of the university where departments, for some set of reasons, have gotten in trouble. Either their internal rapport has broken down or their quality has faded. It's very clear that you need some new blood, and maybe you needed it at the leadership role.
Oh, I see. So this is weak departments that are in question.
Sure, weak departments. Mm-hmm. And at any moment in our history, you can look around and say, that department is weak. We either fold it up or we do something to get it out of this malaise. And I guess my feeling is that if you get to that spot, and there are a couple of them now that are in Madison that are going through that turmoil, you better bring in somebody at the level where they have the security, and through the system you bring them in with tenure. Mm-hmm. You bring in somebody who's mature so that they're not fighting this hurdle of academic acceptance at the same time that they're knocking heads together. Somehow, you know, you've got to get that, but you better bring in somebody seasoned and mature, and if you can't get it through a departmental executive committee, maybe you have to give some additional support to a department. And that's happened in recent years in Madison.
What are the departments that are having trouble now?
I think the one that is most interesting right now is educational administration. And the old hands, the mature season crop is going out. It's a department that has had trouble defining its scholarship. And they need, and they've got a heavy load, particularly at the level of graduate training. And they have not done well in recent years getting assistant professors promoted. And so you either infuse from the outside or you figure out some way to strengthen that by a recombination of forces. We had the same problem a couple of years ago with comparative literature, as you know. And so there are times when the body, the elected faculty, and the administration have to work together to deal with a real problem, without destroying this very precious business of autonomy and the granting of tenure.
Mm-hmm.
So that's I think an ongoing issue, and we're pretty mature in general in our codes, but there are some spots, and this is one I think where the rights of a person being reviewed, and on the other hand, the need to make sure that the institution is moving. There's still some work. Do you want to talk about the student rights for a minute?
Right.
Or do you want to jump into that, a different topic?
Whatever you think.
This is going to be fascinating because there's room for a lot of new understanding and a relook at things. The area that we're talking about specifically is student life and interest. Mm-hmm. In its broadest scope, almost everything is student life and interest. What makes it interesting is that part of the tuition, part of the obligatory tuition, is segregated fees. These segregated fees are not part of the instructional budget. They are fees that go to support the union or the health service and or student government and or intramural sports or all of these kinds of things in which students engage that are not part of the curriculum. The statute now says that students have a right to actively participate in those things that are primarily of their interest. Some students interpret this to say that maybe we have the sole authority to determine those things, and this is a significant amount of money. So they say that either on the committees that administer these things, we ought to be the only people on the committee, and or we ought to have the majority. And you're talking about things like the student union. Is it the student union? Well, of course it's not, because the community participates in the union. Part of their revenue is segregated fees. Part of it is fee revenue. People pay when they go there. But the students say, no, that's ours. We have the primary authority. They argue that we have the authority over intramural and or individual recreational facilities, like the gymnasia. And we should have control over the budget. Or they argue that job placement is our primary interest, and we should have authority on the job placement service and or who's allowed on the campus to recruit. And then if you do those sorts of things, it's subject to the vagaries of student government. And on the one hand, you could say, well, what are you worried about? These are elected people. On the other hand, it's a transitory kind of thing because students come and go. So ahead of us is defining what is student life and interests, and what is the role of students in the governance, and what is the role of students in the management of that money. That's going to be an interesting balance. And the university committee is struggling with that, trying to work with the students. It's a little bit different now about the argument about whether or not there is racism and whether or not the students who are in the minorities should have the authority to decide whether or not there is racism and where that is occurring, and then have authority to take action if they think it is. Should, for example, some kind of a committee of students, elected or otherwise, have the right to give the charter to fraternities to be on the campus? And some students are saying they should. Well, this would be a sharp change from traditionally how these things have been decided. I think this is going to be in front of us for several years before it's worked out in some realignment. This is not in the area of faculty rights and responsibilities in academia, but it's how we manage the larger setting in which we're operating.
When did this start becoming a serious issue with students? When did they start fighting for this?
I think in reality it's an outgrowth of the unhappiness in the Vietnam era. Mm-hmm. It's a new wave of people, but it's... I wouldn't say that the faculty and or the administration were autocratic to the end of the 1960s. But it's quite clear that things are more participatory now than they were in the 1960s. And we're still working out the arrangements about the level of participation and the degree of authority that various groups have. And this attempt now by students to redefine where their authority is, with a lot of pressure, is just the current manifestation of that.
Has something come up this year? Is there some particular person who's president of the Student Government Association who's fighting for this?
Sure. Yeah. And in some ways, the people who are pressing this are the same people who've been pressing the TAA bargaining for graduate assistance. The bargaining for graduate assistance, the main argument, and it's far from resolved, is over the scope of bargaining. That's another manifestation mm-hmm. of this same kind of a revolutionary ferment that's underway.
You mean, but the graduate students are influencing the undergraduate students?
Yes. There's an overlap in the leadership. Mm-hmm. Some of the people who are on the bargaining team for the TAA are making the same kinds of arguments about students' primary interests. This is not entirely, it's not just the right to take part in the decisions on the allocation of funds kind of thing, because there are political goals as well involved in it. Mm. It's whether or not the CIA should be allowed to recruit on the campus, or Dow Chemical, or whether or not the university should be accepting any research money from the university regardless of whether or not it's classified.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not certain kinds of courses should be taught to the undergrads. There's a movement that would say we should have a right to help decide what the curriculum is. Another very specific and interesting, fascinating issue is whether or not we should permit the ROTC to remain on campus. And all of these, so there are political issues woven into this as well as sharing and carving up the cow pasture.
Does this pit the conservative versus against the radical students? It sounds, most of the causes you've mentioned seem to be the ones
sure.
that radical students
yeah, and
support.
That's the whole basis of the argument over the student regent that Governor Thompson has nominated mm-hmm. and has not been confirmed by the Senate, as a matter of fact was voted down. Even the issue of whether or not there should be a student regent, see, as part of this movement. That bill was introduced and passed by Representative Clarenbach. I think there's still a lot of doubt in people's minds about the effectiveness of a student regent. And if there is a student on the Board of Regents, why shouldn't there be a faculty person on the Board of Regents and or a member of the academic staff?
Yeah.
They are all major elements in the community. So the this whole student upwelling about redefining our role is very much a part of what we're dealing with. The ROTC issue is fascinating. It is a law of Congress, a statute, federal law, that homosexuality is illegal. That's part of the federal statutes. We have a law which prevents this kind of behavior. You want to change
yeah.
that? It is part of the policy of the Department of Defense and other federal agencies that being a member of the armed forces or being granted a commission, the Army can deny a status and or a commission on the basis of this personal sexual preference. If you want to be a cadet at the University of Wisconsin in the ROTC, you have to sign an affidavit which says, I am not a practicing homosexual, and furthermore, I don't even have an intent to be one. And you have to sign that and say, I have no thoughts in that direction, and I am not. The argument is that that is contradictory to the state statute, which reserves to privacy personal preference, and that the state statute is in conflict, and even if it weren't, it's a denial of the right of privacy and of civil rights. The U.S. Supreme Court is ambivalent on this. The rulings have come down in different directions on it. What the students are saying is that the ROTC, you can take a course, but you can't be a cadet. You're not eligible for the very Hansen Scholarship, and you can therefore not serve. And there is no evidence that being a homosexual puts you in jeopardy in terms of your service. In fact, there's some evidence that being heterosexual does put you in jeopardy. So there's an interesting logical argument. Okay, so they say if we don't get response, then we should kick ROTC off the campus. There's another public interest in that, and that is the Civilian Officer Corps and dispersing it across the country so that you have a balanced Civilian Officer Corps in the armed forces. And there is the right of access for people who want to do that, some 200 now on our campus. So you have what is in effect a constitutional rights battle being fought out on our campus with some interesting arguments on both sides. Regardless of whether or not you believe that homosexuality is a cardinal sin, it's being fought out on the basis of conflicting rights. University committee is right in the middle of that.
Could you say how the discussion is going and what their
ad hoc committee was appointed with faculty and students. It was a balanced committee. We are still waiting the final draft of their report. There is a majority of report which is against the policy of the armed forces, the Department of Defense. A minority report which is strongly stated on the other side, and now we understand we're getting answers to the minority report. Mm-hmm. It will be on the agenda of the Senate probably in December. The University Committee will bring it to the Senate, mm-hmm. and we'll discuss it. We'll see.
The most you can do is presumably recommend, is that right?
That's right. The Senate could recommend to the administration at one extreme, let's close it out, the program, because it's in conflict either with our sentiment and or the state statutes. And then another institution somewhere else in the country would grab this program because there are a lot waiting in line for the right to have this program. We're only one of a handful that have it in all three of the main services, Army, Navy, Air Force, so it's a very juicy kind of thing that universities like. On the other end, we can say that this is totally out of our hands, it's in the hands of Congress and or the courts. And we, the state of Wisconsin, have no authority to tell the federal government what they shall do in policy. In between, there's some lobby, statement kind of position. The contextual issue here is that this is part of this realignment of who participates and in what way.
What's your own, where would you vote?
On that? I see no logical or ethical reason to ban these people from the armed forces. Come down solidly on the side of saying it is not relevant to effective service. Mm-hmm. There are personal behaviors of wide scope that can get you in trouble. In part, my reaction is based on being a former officer and having to deal with these cases in the service, an array of personal behavior kind of cases. I see ethically, philosophically, tactically, no reason to ban these people from the armed forces. You have codes of behavior that you have to comply with in a tight, difficult situation, but why select this one? Mm-hmm. That comes out of my own personal belief.
But how would you vote on whether to keep ROTC?
I would vote to keep ROTC on the campus. at this time and vigorously pursue the other issue. And this is the reason that I'm absolutely convinced, number one, that you need a civilian officer corps, and that you need to keep this officer corps coming from all corners of the country. And I know that on the basis of philosophical grounds, it would be possible to get our officer corps from one part of the country, and I think this would be a grave error. And I think that's overriding at this to maintain that system. So I would say my personal feeling, and this is how I will argue in the debate, is keep it on and then go after a change in policy at the only level where you can effectively change it anyway.
Do you think most of your colleagues on the committee have the same view?
We haven't discussed it. I don't know that yet. Mm. Next time around, I'll have a better sense. Mm. But I know how I stand on it. I have deep convictions to keep this within the universities. The modulating effect, I think, is terribly important. On the other hand, I have just as strong convictions on the individual rights, right of privacy thing. But I think you fight it out in Congress and in the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. Somebody has got to step forward and take that case into the courts. They might lose it. The court is ambiguous on privacy kinds of things. So that's this redistribution of the balance of decision-making power is very much with us. It's going to be fascinating.
Presumably this has been going on, well, you more or less said that, ever since the merger.
Yes. In the immediate post-merger years, we had a period in, and I want to say something more about that in just a minute, where the momentum has shifted toward centralized top-down decision-making. We had and I think I've talked about this before, the Lucy years, where there was this whole business of accountability and management by planning and all this kind of stuff. And the outcome of that was really what put us in trouble in the budget, because the planners said, if you don't comply with these kinds of things, you lose money, or you don't get the money associated with the enrollment increases. The Ed Young years, when he was in president, were quiet in that regard. Young really understood the system of distributed decision making. To a certain extent, under the last two presidents, we're back in that business of management from the top. Let me give you an example of that. Under the current budget, we have been asked by the governor and the legislature to look again at our mission statements. And there's a very strong tendency from the system administration to tell the various institutions what's going to be in their mission statements. There are some things that come forth that are simply not possible. For example, a lot of the four-year campuses would like to have research written into their mission statements. Scholarship is different from research in the mission statements. At any given time, you have struggles over where the decisions get made. But rewriting the mission statements is a crucial point. Do you let this flow up and react to it, or do you prescribe the wording and hand it down? And there's a tendency, on those kinds of issues, there's a tendency to hand it down.
Even to Madison?
Even to Madison. Hmm. Even to Madison. Another example of that, the legislature appropriated a fund this time for applied research. Our whole attitude about defining research and competitive funding has to let it come up from the bottom, let faculty propose, PIs be competitive, be reviewed. But under this budget now, suddenly there is a segregated fund that you can compete with, and system will hand it out. It's a very modest amount, but it's a basic shift in the way we have allocated research funding. So the criteria for what's important and for quality are being defined in system on this fund. And then you can ask for it, and we'll give it to you. As I said, it's still very modest, but it's a change in the way. If you have a system authority, over what do they have authority? And there's this constant, well, we got to carve out these places where we really do rule. And this is a little bit different than the division of authority among the students and the staff and the faculty. It's a hierarchical kind of thing, so it's a different issue.
You mean a faculty member could go to the system and say, I develop a different gauge railway or something, and get a grant for it,
yes,
without going through the research committee?
Yes, in this particular category. See, the research committee, the graduate school research committee here is all powerful within the areas in which they operate.
Yeah.
But you're essentially talking about the funds that the grad school administers, WARF and or other categorized funds. There is an administrative review to see that you comply with the rules on human safety and these kinds of things, and on overhead. But if you, the individual researcher, says, I have an idea, I conceptualize it, I'm going to go out and compete for funds wherever they are, possibly including the legislature, you've been able to do that. You might get the funding, you might not. Mm-hmm. Hopefully there's a peer review, not a political review. But now what we have is system administration saying, this is our budget.
Ooh.
And we're going to allocate it among the various institutions around the state in some proportionate way, and you propose to us. And this is new and different.
I should say so. It seems extraordinary. So this is research funding, and
yes,
yet other campuses except Milwaukee are not supposed to be.
The institution doesn't have a major research mission.
But I see, but the individual.
But depending on the time and their contractual commitments, they can be involved in research. I mean, there's nothing that denies the right of scholarship. It's just whether or not. Well, for example, some of the other system institutions believe that if they can get a research mission written into their mission statement, they would then be automatically eligible to compete for WARF funds, the Wisconsin Alumni Research Funds. The argument there would be that that is a fund in support of the system, not of the Madison campus. Most people in Madison would laugh uproariously, and do when they hear that. And yet, you see, it's so you would expect.
Wait, finish that. I happen to be doing some interviews with WARF people. It's amazing to me that that's even considered a possibility anymore. I know it was.
Yeah. Or let's consider the fact that certain research funds come to the university on the basis of the land grant status. Mm. There are other people who would say it's not fair that Madison gets those funds and has control over them. And really that should be reallocated to the system, and then there would be some kind of a proportionate distribution of that funding.
But those issues were settled, I thought.
Never settled.
The WARF issue was.
Yes. And that's a wild kind of idea. But the point is, it's in the minds of some
there.
People.
Mm.
And but if the balance to do this sort of thing gradually shifts upward in the system, and then you have a change in administration, and somebody comes along and says, why not?
Did the chancellor fight this legislative proposal for applied research funds?
I don't know. It's very, very difficult to fight that publicly. Mm-hmm. Because it's a proposal from the politicians. They say we want the university to be more responsive to the needs of the state. Yeah. You know that the politicians are going to represent their region, and they're committed to representing their region. And so that's it's very difficult to fight that kind of thing. The only way you fight that is on the basis of the quality of the proposals that are made and the quality of the results. And over time, if you're good, you're going to accrue most of those funds anyway. If there are 20 proposals and there is a qualitative review, then let it go where the quality is.
So one can well imagine that the review might have some people on it who would,
of course, well,
enough like to have money go elsewhere that they would fudge a bit.
Of course, sure. But it's the introduction of this instrument that is a change. If it's a modest amount, so what? But suddenly if it's half of the research budget, then you have changed the structure.
Yeah.
There's one other, how long do you want this interview to go for this afternoon? We're going to get back together later.
Yes, well, I think as much as you want to say. We're limited to 2 hours, I guess.
Yeah. I don't have 2 hours this afternoon. And there's one other topic I want to bring up.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure yet that I understand, because it's going to take some more time for this to happen. There is a trend in higher education in the United States for the development of professional administrators. These are people who start their careers intending to end up as presidents of universities. Mm-hmm. And a job opens up around the country, and you have a search and screen procedure. And people apply, and increasingly these are the pros. And they tend to come from the departments of Ed administration around the country. Time will tell. For the first time in the history of this institution, UW-Madison, University of Wisconsin, we have two outsiders running the ship, in the president and the chancellor. I have no fears about the incoming chancellor. But there's going to be a period when this outsider will have to learn about this almost unique system of shared governance and decide how comfortable she is with it. And it's going to be an interesting time in that regard, because the last time we had a, quote, outsider as president of the university was in the 1930s.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a 50-year time span of having raised our own. And by and large, I think we've been exceedingly lucky with the quality of people. Could have gone the other way, you know, you could have had a disaster, but we really haven't. We've had a series of very good presidents, then chancellors. This is a new era. We have, in fact, two professional administrators now. And what's that period of adjustment going to be like? I think at this early point, the vibes on Shalala are all very good. But we'll see. And I know that she's gotten lots of advice about getting close to the faculty part of the shared governance. Spend your time there. She comes out of an institution where it's been structured from the top down in Hunter College. And so it's going to be an interesting time to see how this works out. And whether or not a year from now we're at cross purposes on some of these fundamental issues. I don't expect that to happen, but it's different. It's a change in our history. And so a lot of people are going to be watching that shared governance. It has zilch to do with the fact that we have our first woman in command. It's the key issue is this outsider and whether or not they understand the delicateness but at the same time the strength of this system of dispersed power that we have. So that's going to make life interesting.
Have you, from what you say, Kenneth Shaw must be exerting a good deal of power from the system.
Correct.
One doesn't get a sense of that. It's nothing in the newspapers.
I want to quit for a minute for this
good.
Time.
Well, we just have about 5 minutes.
But repeatedly in the instrumentalizing of policy, the philosophy is we'll lay out the rules here and then you comply. I mean, that's kind of built in to what we have. We have a strong, aggressive, intelligent administration that is going to make the system work. And my answer is maybe. Maybe. If you start to destruct this system of shared decision making in order to do that, the faculty have the will, they have the power. It's innate because they are operating at the point of the decisions. You know, and we have 150 years of history of having this power. And so you can have a struggle, but the power still rests with the faculty. And do you do this in a prosperous way, or do you do it in a destructive way, is the issue.
You say the faculty does have the power.
Sure.
You mean they can all quit, or?
They can do it their way. It's a little bit like tasting the freedom. If on an issue like this, if we are told that we have to superimpose on our curriculum some standard general education requirements, and if we are further told that you've got to measure kids when they come in, and then you've got to measure them at some later point, prove that the general education is working or is not working. The faculty has the power to do that or not. They might be wise to do it, but they can make it work or not. That's what I mean by the balance of power. You know, at the level of instruction, curriculum, staffing, those decisions will be made at the lower level. There can be a lot of hassle over compliance and reporting and all of that kind of stuff.
Like the Regent insistence that American history be taught back in the 1940s and the way that was handled.
Sure. And you don't want to get in a situation of guerrilla warfare over those things. You want an understanding back and forth. And that to me is the important issue that the new chancellor faces, coming in and understanding this excellent, superb, one of the best in the world institutions, and why it's that way. And governance is a very key part of that. And I my reaction is she has the smarts to understand that, but we'll see at the working level.
Well, that seems to be the end of the tape. Mm-hmm. Shall we?